Today on Movie Wallets, we talk about Hotel Artemis, Disobedience, and Incredibles 2. It's time for Movie Wallets. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashby.
And Yoski as well.
Movie Wallets is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this podcast is for you.
Ooh.
Greetings all.
I like how you changed it at the end.
Well, I guess it's a podcast, not a show. We did do a show.
Yes, we did. Less than a week ago,
Beth Accomando at KPBS and the KPBS Producers Club
and NPR
through NPR, indeed. Yeah, so it was kind of an interesting experience. I guess we should talk about what it was. It was the
we're just like, oh, we had a great time, let's move on.
Well, KPBS, for those that don't listen to public radio, shame on you. And those of you who listen but don't donate to public radio.
Shame on you.
They have a producers club for people who, I think it's give like $100 a month. It's kind of a group of people, and they get exposed to different events, $100 or more. They get access to special events and things. And one of these special events happened to be us, which was a celebration of Bollywood. And they did it at the new Comic-Con Center in San Diego, which is still really a building site at this point in time. But it's what used to be the old Hall of Champions.
What a great show. I think it's going to be amazing.
But it was great evening. They had Indian food, and Rashmi Yazdi, you did a wonderful talk all about Bollywood.
Thank you.
And
Joe put all of the IT production together, and we had clips and a lovely slide set that we were able to work with, and everything worked wonderfully.
It was wonderful because we had clips followed by movie posters, followed by, you know,
us talking,
artwork, and talking. It was very good. It was a full 1 hour, and it wasn't enough for us to get through the entire history of Bollywood or Indian cinema. So.
Yeah, I don't want to toot our own horn too much, but guys, you rocked.
And, thanks.
I wish maybe we can do this at some other forum to open it up to more people, because I think it was a really great
little
tour. I learned a lot about Bollywood in doing it, I think.
Nicest compliments we got after the show was over and we got to speak to some of the audience was, you know, I never knew Bollywood was like this.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, the one thing that I learned about this, I mean, I've seen a couple of Bollywood movies, but, you know, you do kind of forget, and you go back to kind of pigeonholing it into the all singing, all dancing, all kind of...
Which it can be,
mm-hmm. But it's like calling, you know, all Hollywood movies Sylvester Stallone, Rambo type movies. I mean, you know, that may be a perception that people in other countries have about Hollywood.
Yeah, and yet, Sound of Music.
Hollywood movies, as we all know, as we've managed to generate almost 400 episodes of podcasts about, are so much more than that. So hopefully we picked up a couple of listeners at the event, and if you're listening,
welcome
to the podcast, and maybe you can give us an email or a like on Facebook as well. That would be great. But that was fun, and hopefully the people that watched it enjoyed it. Okay, we have this week to talk about three movies, but
I've been dying to speak about one of them.
We did promise in our last episode to do a Netflix pick, so I think we would be remiss in our this is kind of a buy time type spiel.
Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story is on Netflix.
Yes.
Is that a Netflix pick? Do you want to start?
Also, the Barbie movie that I watched at Tribeca, remember Tiny Shoulders, is on Hulu.
Oh, okay.
It's now streaming live on Hulu. Please watch it. If you have any interest in Barbie the doll or Barbie, not Bobby, remember Barbie.
Barbie.
Yeah. Yes. B-A-R for rabbit or Rashmi.
Yes.
B-I-E. Yes. Tiny Shoulders. Great documentary.
Yes.
Okay, so Netflix pick.
I'll go first. It's an easy one for me. It's the movie which won Best Documentary last year. It's a movie that I defy anyone to watch and not come away with a wistful feeling about the meaning of life and how, even when you're old, you can do things which are meaningful. And it's the documentary called Faces, Places.
Yes.
Which, you know, which there were some amazing documentaries last year, but this one still won, and it very rightfully won. And it's, you know, it's just, I don't know, it seems almost miraculous. And Agnes Varda, who is, you know, one of the original co-founders of the French New Wave, she's made, I don't know, 30, 40 movies. She just takes off on this journey with this conceptual artist. His name is, he just goes by the initials JR. And the two of them, essentially, they're able to print out these large, I don't even know how to explain it. They kind of go about printing like large scale images that they then paste on different structures. And it sounds like a silly, goofy thing to do, but it has just in its own little way has so much meaning.
Yeah, this was one of my top picks for best foreign, well, it's not best foreign language, it's best documentary. In fact, JR, the muralist JR, was actually on a 60-minute segment very recently. If any of you have DVR or happen to DVR 60 Minutes,
I think you can get it online as well. Yeah,
and you'll get the gist of what he was doing, and Faces, Places is mentioned in that 60-minute segment. This is one of the most delightful movies I've seen, not just from the perspective of what they're doing, because what they're doing is making some sort of political statement. Mm-hmm. When they make these big stickers that they end up, posters really, yeah, they're like life-size posters that they end up,
people's
but
faces.
More than life-size, they're kind of building size.
The mural type
they're more than life-size, they're like hundreds of times bigger than life-size.
Right,
yeah.
So that within itself would be an interesting documentary.
An example of one that he did recently was on the border wall. They're testing the Trump's border wall, mm-hmm. In parts of San Diego. So just over the border in Mexico, they did a very huge piece
of a baby.
Of a baby
looking over,
climbing over the wall.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But because it was on the non-US side, there was nothing any of the authorities here could do anything about it. So it was a big statement.
Wow.
And he actually did one in a favela recently on some steps in a favela of a lady who lived in the favela. So that was very interesting
favela,
as well.
For those that don't know, it's a Brazilian slum.
Yes. Yeah. But again, I was saying that part is interesting within itself, the mechanism of doing it. The thing that I found delightful was this wonderful relationship, friendship, that this old lady who's an amazing artist has with this young guy who's a muralist.
It just gives me hope, exactly. I mean, even if you don't care anything about art or murals or whatever, it's just this very wistful, tender relationship between two artists who are completely separated by age, separated by medium. And yet they take off on this journey with the camera and they do what they think is right. And it, in the moment, it might not mean much, but it just adds up to something indelible. It's just, it's, you know, I'll pay you back if you don't love this film. It's just, you owe yourself a favor. Watch it. Faces, Places is the name of the documentary.
So I get a bonus one because I mentioned Tiny Shoulders for Hulu, but I know a lot of people don't have Hulu, and this is Netflix picks. So I'm going back in time to Sliding Doors.
Yes.
Which is the movie by... that stars Gwyneth Paltrow. And I love this whole concept of fate versus your you know, fate and destiny versus your right to choose your life and what happens. And so for those of you that haven't seen it, please rush and see this one. This is a really simple movie about what would happen if you left 10 minutes later. How would your life be different if you didn't take that train?
And if I may just...
yes, please
contradict
do.
Contradict you by saying it only seems a very simple film.
Correct.
The plot is so beautiful. Essentially, Gwyneth Paltrow's life bifurcates into two, depending on whether she catches her train on the way to work or if she's delayed. And those two universes, you know, follow in parallel And the great genius of the script is that eventually those two universes actually dovetail. And it's not a gimmick. It works beautifully. It has a lot to say about a lot of things. It's quite a lovely
It's from
film.
1998. It was actually written and directed by a guy called Peter Howitt. Mm-hmm. And Peter Howitt at the time was very famous for being an almost comedian in a TV series that used to be called Bread, about kind of working class life in the Merseyside, right?
Gotta get out.
That's it. Yeah, it had a theme tune. It was about a family. It was a really interesting sitcom within itself. And it was amazing to me that he suddenly came out with this movie.
Yeah,
terrific stuff. I agree with that pick. Both those picks, actually. I didn't see Faces Places, but
you saw me like smiling widely.
Faces Places, with glee. So my pick is going to be a movie that, and I can't believe I'm going to be recommending this, because the one I really want to pick, and this is a bonus pick.
Is this a Bollywood?
Is Wind River. Oh. But no, I'm not going to pick Wind River, because that was a movie that I think we may have already recommended here.
Did you just try and get a bonus one in?
I did. My actual choice this week is a movie by director Tim Burton.
Really? Oh my God.
And for those who are listening, the reason that they're reacting like that is I've gone on record many a time saying I detest Tim, and it's beyond hate.
Which one are you going to pick?
The movie Big Eyes. So really?
Believe it. Yeah.
I'm getting this reaction. I actually really enjoyed Big Eyes. It was a movie from a couple of years ago. It stars Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, and it was about the artist Walter Keane, who was very famous for painting those kind of very stylized pictures of characters that had, you know, very large eyes. And it's not a plot spoiler. This is what the movie is essentially about. It turns out, and this is based on a true story, it turns out that those pictures were painted by his wife, and that she was the artist behind all of it. So I just found that movie to work really well. And I think, you know, it's had mixed reviews. I mean, it's a 72% on the Tomatometer. So ignore the groans from my colleagues here. I think the world didn't seem to dislike this one as much as the two of them. But I really thought Amy Adams did a great job here. Christoph Waltz can be very hit or miss here, but he was really, he's really good at this kind of despicable character that you know, we're meant to dislike, and he's very good at that here, and I think he did a nice job. And it's an odd Tim Burton movie in that I don't think it has any of Tim Burton's usual signatures, which if the movie hadn't,
except the artwork of the big eyes,
eyes, and I guess to some extent the movie has that kind of very saturated color look that you know, a little bit surreal, but I just thought it was a very nicely told story. I thought Amy Adams was excellent in here, and I think she's as good here as she has been since, you know, Junebug, because she also has a very hit or miss career in terms of her performance. But I really like that one. So Big Eyes, and Yazdi, you had Faces Places, and Rashmi, you
Sliding
had
Doors.
Sliding Doors. And I've gotten a couple of requests to include those movies in the show notes. So remind me to do that when I publish a podcast. If I don't, Michelle, that's for you, because I don't want to hear you telling me again that you need to see them in the show notes, because you're driving while you're listening to the show.
Yeah,
so
fair enough. Yeah.
I'll try.
But
and
don't
that.
Read and drive.
Yes.
Don't read and drive. Yes. Drive safely.
Movie
Wallace
does not endorse reading and driving.
Or anything in driving.
Well, apart from listening to Movie Wallace and driving.
Yes, that you can. If you have a Bluetooth, yes.
Okay, so let's move on. We've got three movies to cover. Mm-hmm. We have Hotel Artemis, Disobedience, and The Incredibles 2. Or should I say Incredibles 2? I think that's the correct statement here. So where would you like to begin? In that order?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, Hotel Artemis. This movie, and I'll just read its Rotten Tomatoes description here. It's set in riot-torn near-future Los Angeles. Hotel Artemis is an original high-octane action thriller starring Jodie Foster as a character called The Nurse, who runs a secret members-only hospital for criminals. She's joined by an all-star cast that includes Sterling K. Brown, Sophia Boutella, Jeff Goldblum, Brian Tyree Henry, Jenny Slate, Zachary Quinto, Charlie Day, and David Bautista. Movie's written, directed by Drew Pearce. I believe it's his very first movie as a director, although he has penned. He was known for writing the script to Iron Man 3. So,
Charlie Day's missing off that list.
No, I said it. I said
you Charlie did. Sorry.
Day. Yep, you weren't paying attention. guys, what did you think of Hotel Artemis?
Yes, he's written volumes.
And I'm going to say a little anecdote about this. The very first trip that I took with my father at the age of 13 was to the island of Corfu in Greece. And our hotel was called the Artemis Hotel.
Oh, really?
So when I saw the title of this movie, I was like, I can't believe they've made a movie about the Artemis Hotel. Just for the record.
In Corfu.
It was not the same hotel.
Thank God.
But it was such a random thing. I was like, I didn't even tell you about that, Rashmi. I was like, oh my God, that's like a childhood trip and memory of mine. It's like Artemis Hotel. And it was a 2-star. It was a time when my father didn't believe that mosquitoes existed outside Africa. So he would settle down to the evening for the evening with a nightcap. I would be in the bed alongside him in the same room. I'd wake up in the morning covered in these like welts that he was thinking I was allergic to something. He thought maybe I'd eaten something.
And he's a doctor.
He's a doctor. He's diagnosing me with smallpox and all sorts of things. And I was like, Dad, I think it's mosquitoes. He's like, nonsense. We don't get them here.
There's no mosquitoes in Greece.
You get mosquitoes in Africa. So anyway, random segue there. Yes, you take away your review of the Hotel Artemis.
The movie to me is like, having watched the movie, to me, the experience was like finding lost art. I really love this movie. There was no reason for me to love this movie. Maybe I had exceptionally low expectations from it, but I just love everything about the movie. And I think the movie is set in this kind of dystopian future where, you know, entire Los Angeles has gone to rot and the whole city is in flames, and it kind of exists in the same universe as the John Wick movies almost, where, you know, Hotel Artemis is a place where, you know, criminals can go and get themselves treated if they're hurt. It's actually a...
Well, anyone willing to pay.
Anyone willing to pay. It's actually a front for a hospital. It's a covert hospital. And maybe you shouldn't even call it a hospital. It's like 3 or 4 people who are running this joint where you can get medically treated if you can pay enough. So it's a fascinating concept, but... For me, the winning part about the movie, which just amazed me, was the casting in this movie. Everybody here, I haven't seen Zachary Quinto quite like this. I haven't seen Jodie Foster like this. We don't see enough of her in cinema. And, you know, this is the first time I've seen her play like a visibly really old person. I mean, she has a lot of makeup on, but she plays an old woman. I haven't seen Jeff Goldblum like this, which goes a long ways. David Bautista, Jenny Slate, these are all, you know, very interesting choice of characters. And the movie was completely unpredictable. I did not know where it was headed. It was always ahead of me. It just filled me up. I enjoyed this movie so much.
I'm with you, SD. I knew nothing about this movie walking in, other than I knew Jodie Foster was in it. And I kept hearing about it through all of the PR stuff that we normally get exposed to. Yazdi, same thing. This is like John Wick, the even more unbelievable graphic novel version. It felt fresh and different. The only thing I'll say is it did feel much more like a short story than a full...
Yeah,
you know, fully realized narrative. I like that this institution had its own law and rules.
Yeah.
But it felt a little bit devoid of story is what I'll say. Much more style over content. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. But absolutely brilliant. This was such a fun time at the movie.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Joe, come on. Don't
oh, it's one
on
of those.
It.
Okay.
Don't poop on Hotel Artemis.
I'm not going to, but I think... you know, this is, in fact, I mentioned, you know, the 13-year-old Joe in Corfu at the Artemis Hotel. that 13-year-old Joe, I think, would have very much more liked this movie than the
40-something. You can leave it there.
the many years older Joe, the gray-bearded Joe that is watching this now. You know, this movie was fine. I think it had this very stylized feel to it. And graphic novel, Rashmi, you described that it felt very much like a graphic novel. The world is what it is. It has its own rules and kind of setting. I guess the thing that I struggled with more than anything was that I wanted to know a little bit more about the world beyond the hotel. I think, you know, budget probably didn't allow them to shoot that riot-torn Los Angeles. We had to take it on faith that there were riots going on outside the hotel. So it all felt very kind of a stage play in some ways. You know, you had this kind of exit left, enter right kind of, visual dynamic going on. But, you know, much like a stage play, I think the geography, yes, you always comment on the geography of a scene. And, you know, we could tell at any point in time exactly how this set was assembled and who was coming from where and where the danger lay and where the escape routes were. So it was okay. It was adequate entertainment. I wished it had given us just a little bit more to go on than it did. It was not about anything bigger than the events of a few hours in this hotel. And that felt just a little frustrating for me.
Yeah, I think frustrating is a good word.
I'm a sucker for ambitious design and ambitious thought. And, you know, this is sometime in the future. We don't know exactly when. But I love the part that the movie starts essentially with Jodie Foster being essentially the keeper of this hospital, right? She's the person who you come to if you're a criminal and if you have a bullet wound and, you know, if you have the money to come here, then she will treat you. And everything at her disposal. I mean, she's a one person army. She has like, you know, maybe one other person, the Dave Bautista character, who helps her, and she single handedly runs this. Again, hospital would be too generous a term, but this medical facility. And you know, it's sometime in the future, and she has these machines which are kind of able to do some kind of automated surgery. It's some kind of futuristic X-ray device, and everything is kind of broken down.
Kind of like that thing in Prometheus. Do you remember that?
Very Prometheus-like, exactly. And the hotel is very art deco, but it has this kind of broken down modern medical devices. And everybody who is a guest in the hotel, I call it a hotel, but it's really this place where you get treated for medical conditions, you know, has a secret. There's a Sofia Boutella character who plays, you know, this impossibly wicked.
And she was Gazelle assassin. The Kingsman.
Yeah. And then Charlie Day is this character who comes there, and he's this cocky person. And then you keep hearing about this Wolfie character, you know, you keep hearing about this bad guy. He's the mayor of Los Angeles, and he's the ultimate, you know, mafia guy, and you know, he's arriving, and everybody's scared of him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't show up until the last act of the movie, and you kind of built up with anticipation, and then you find out that it's Jeff Goldblum, and you're always happy to see Jeff Goldblum on the screen. And then, you know, Zachary Quinto plays his son, kind of the son who has fallen out of favor from his father because he doesn't believe that his son is brave enough to kind of follow his line. And there's this tension between father and son. So even though there isn't much story, these characters are built with a lot of fondness, I think. I really like the relationship between the Dave Bautista character and Jodie Foster. Jodie Foster has her own backstory, which really is the weakest part of the whole movie because it's about a lost child and blah, 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 you know, Sandra Bullock in Gravity. You know?
So no spoilers there.
Yeah, no spoilers. But anyway, sorry guys. But it's just, as a piece, it holds so beautifully together. The script is so good. There's so many scenes of them trying to kind of, you know, in secret get a person out of that hotel while somebody else is coming, and they go up and down these stairs so many times. It has a really good sense of geography. I kind of felt I knew the rooms and I knew who was in each room and what was going on.
And I take a lot of care over that device.
Yeah.
Right? Like each room has its own name, and each guest or patient is known by the room name as opposed to their real name. I mean, it's very well realized. I guess, not to cut you off, Yazdi, I think the one thing I struggled with was, and it didn't take away from my enjoyment of the movie, was it was tonally inconsistent. So Charlie Day, you know, Charlie Day's great.
He's great.
And you bring him in when you want comedy, and he delivers.
Although it's not the usual Charlie Day.
It's not the usual Charlie Day, but it's kind of like the Charlie Day that we almost, that was, what was the recent movie? Pacific Rim. It was more along the lines of Pacific Rim Charlie Day to me. And so it kind of leads you down this path because he's in it quite a lot to start with. This is going to be comedic, but it's not comedic at all. In fact, it's bone-crushingly violent. Mm-hmm. But the fight scenes are so inventive, I couldn't take my eyes off the screen for 1 second. I mean, Quentin Tarantino would be proud.
Yeah.
Sofia Bautista, I think her name is. Batella. She's incredible in this movie. I mean, she's done a lot of kind of, you know, number two parts.
Yeah, she was
she's perfectly cast in this movie. And my God, she brings that girl power.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could fight like that in a long red dress, wow.
Yeah.
I just felt that was kind of cliche. I mean,
really?
This is the femme fatale that we've seen. You know, she has to. She's
actually been in Atomic Blonde.
Yeah, right. She was in Atomic Blonde. She was the femme fatale. Yeah.
But, you know, she's playing the kind of, you know, the Latina you don't mess with kind of thing. And I just felt.
But I believed her. I was scared of her. I believe she was a kick-ass assassin.
Sure. It just felt very cliche to me as a character. And, you know, same with the Charlie Day. It did. It came right from Pacific Rim, that same tonality. You know, so I felt like many of those ideas were a little tired. The nurse character, you know, they call her the nurse. You know, I didn't quite buy the universe. I didn't quite buy that she was all-knowing and all-able and able to fix things and fix people and treat any injury. You know, it didn't hang to me as plausible. And any kind of movie that is as stylized as this movie is still needs to have that little thread of plausibility. It needs to make sense within its universe. The John Wick is a great one because, you know, you do have this kind of hotel that the assassins go to, and you know they're perfectly safe there. They pay.
As is this supposed to be?
But somehow that fits better within its universe than this one did. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm poking holes in the movie, but I'm poking holes because I really felt that this was shy of what it could have been, and that with the right kind of, you know, who was the director of Kick-Ass?
I know who you mean, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a very specific style. You know, I was going to say the Zack...
Schneider.
Schneider, but it's not a Zack Schneider movie. Let me see if I can look it up.
No, I'm looking it up. Keep going.
So it needed that kind of sass to it. Instead, we kind of got...
Matthew Vaughn,
right. That kind of wicked... You know, sense of humor. I'm not a huge fan of the movie Kick-Ass, but it needed that kind of Kingsman-y, quippy, punchy sharpness to it that it felt like it didn't have.
So I disagree with you on all those counts.
Nonsense.
Yeah.
Don't listen to Joe.
That's actually not the pieces that bothered me. It's interesting you bring up the thing about the long, you know, the fact that she could sort of run this place single-handedly. What I got was a very crucial piece of dialogue, which is she hasn't left that place for the last 40 years. And so I put it down to the plausibility came for me because in that 40 years, she's seen absolutely everything and can deal with every situation that's ever come her way. And she has, like you said, Yazdi, this incredible technology at her hands that these very intelligent, you know, real artificial intelligence at its peak, in a sense, that can diagnose a problem and give you all the medicines all in one go. So I didn't have a problem with that piece, Joe. The piece I had the problem with was, besides the tonality, which I've mentioned, I wish there was just more story. Nothing really seemed to happen. It was just kind of a day in the life. And I think they keep saying it's another night, it's another Monday at the Hotel Artemis. I think she says that about six times throughout the movie. So for me, once I kind of realized it was a graphic novel, it totally worked.
I think it's a character study. It places these characters. You're just watching these characters come and go during the course of, during a course of a night.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people expected it to be, as did I, you know, to be kind of have this great plot about things turning right. a particular way. And it really is one night in this crazy ass hotel of the future. And for me, that was enough. It was more than enough.
That sounds like a sum up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think these days when, you know, anything other than a Marvel or a superhero movie brings in, you know, bums into seats in theaters, I think we need to kind of embrace and champion films that are original, that have a thought, which have incredible casting, great script. So maybe from a plot wise, it's not what you expect, but I just loved everything about the movie. When I came out of it, I felt like I had found buried treasure. I mean, I liked this movie so much and it's kind of stayed with me. I can't wait to watch it again. I'm really looking forward to what Drew Pierce. Yeah, that's what the director's name is, what he does next. 8.5 out of 10, which I'm going to back down to an 8, but
wow.
That seems stingy. I just love this movie. It's unlike anything I've seen this year.
We'll do a Joe sandwich.
Yes.
Go.
You know, I felt like this movie was short of what it could have been, and I find it hard to forgive for that, because as much as I want to recommend this to people, I don't think they'll like me very much for doing so. So I'm going to have to give this a mean 5 out of 10. Yeah, I know. I mean, I think the movie has some genuine moments of...
Gasp!
brilliance, but you know, now I'm the guy that likes this stuff, right? I mean, one of my favorite movies of all time is like John Carpenter's, you know, Assault on Precinct 13, and you know, this has that kind of, you know, dystopian Escape from New York, Escape from LA, those kind of movies back in the day, and it just doesn't hold a candle up to any of those kind of films from my perspective. This is going to come and go. We won't hear much about it, so I feel like. It's not going to get the cult status that I think people...
I do too. Well, time will tell.
Time will tell. So, yeah, 5 out of 10.
So I'm with Yazdi. Yazdi and I are aligned this week. I wouldn't mind another stay at this place if it can come up with a good enough story. I would totally love to go back to the universe. And I think I want to see it again too, Yazdi. So when you buy the DVD, I'm going to come over and watch it with you.
Yeah.
And I think we should force Joe to watch it again.
Yeah. It's just,
there's a lot to take in. I mean, although it's visually, short, there's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. We've got Disobedience and Incredibles 2. So, Yazdi, maybe you want to tell us about Disobedience?
Certainly. So, the director, Sebastian Zelo, broke onto the international... Lilo, actually... Sebastian Lilo, he broke onto the international film circuit a few years ago with the movie Gloria, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you know, that got nominated. It did not win Best Foreign Film that year. But since then, he then went on to make the movie A Fantastic Woman, which was nominated last year for Best Foreign Film. And did you see it? It's
on my list.
It's quite fantastic. And that movie did win the Best Foreign Film last year, Best Foreign Film Oscar. And wouldn't you know it, in less than a few months, he's out with his first English language movie, which is called Disobedience. It's based on a novel of the same name by Naomi Alderman. And it tells the story of a woman who returns to the strict Orthodox Jewish community she was sent away from, when her teenage romance with a female school friend was discovered by the rabbi at this Jewish Orthodox community. And she comes back because the rabbi passes away, and she's back to attend the funeral rites of her father, and she reconnects with her female friend. And it's essentially a story of this forbidden love set within the Orthodox Jewish community set in London. And it stars for the two lead female roles, it stars Rachel Weisz as well as Rachel McAdams. And Alessandro Nivola plays Rachel McAdams' husband, who is heir apparent to take over the role of the rabbi now that the original rabbi has passed. This movie has been, quite well regarded. It came with a lot of, promise. And it actually has opened in the U.S. ahead of any other place. It doesn't open in Europe until October, which is quite surprising to me. But what did you guys... It's been playing for a while now. It's been 2 months since
it was released. Yeah, and it was actually one that played at Tribeca this year. It was on my list of movies to see at Tribeca, but I never got to see the movie.
So what do you guys think of Disobedience?
So Joe and I were talking about this as we came out of the theatre. My home in London, my parents' home in London, is literally 6 miles from this where this community is.
Okay.
And it's like a different world. And that's beautifully conveyed in this movie, is how insular this world is. And it's literally a straight bus ride from where I lived. In fact, I actually saw the bus that I used to take to my school when I was younger. I was like, oh my God, it's the number 83, Joe. And I was like nudging him annoyingly. Okay, so that being said, look, I love Rachel McAdams. I think Rachel McAdams is doing really incredible work. And I think her star hasn't shone as brightly as it should yet. But watch this space. And Rachel Weisz, although I don't necessarily love her, I think she does incredible work as well. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why these two women are Oscar nominated. So I was just dying to see this movie because of them. I wanted this to be less Lifetime than it was. And I always say Lifetime because that to me is the sense of, although it has very explicit sexual scenes in it, I felt like it shied away from having guts to tell a much, I mean, the shock factor is in the obviousness. And I wanted it to be much more gutsy about what it was trying to say. I didn't hate it, but I wanted it to be more.
Joseph?
I know what you're saying that. but with that said, I mean, I think the movie didn't pull any punches. And I'm not obviously just talking about the bedroom scene, which is, you know, a slightly truncated version of Blue is the Warmest Color. It's shorter, but it's
by maybe 1.5 minutes.
No, but it's not. There's almost no nudity. Very little. I mean, it's very, very, very almost. You don't want to watch it. It's so intimate.
Right.
It's very intimate. But yeah, go on.
But that aside, yes. I think the movie did. Did do its job in talking about morality and religion in a way that was very thought-provoking. And for me, it provided kind of a really interesting view into a world that I knew nothing about, right? So there's this London community. It's a Jewish Orthodox community within London. And you know, if you live in London for a time, you'll see but not interact with this community. So I think it did a nice job of kind of letting us in this essentially patriarchal society that exists in plain sight right there in London. And, you know, from that perspective, it was very interesting. And then it put in place this context of, you know, within any kind of religion, this didn't have to be Judaism. This could have been any religion where, you know, most religions are not generally accepting of same-sex couples and engagements and relationships. And so, you know, it placed into this, you know, highly religious world a same-sex, interaction dynamic. And I think it did a nice job of trying to, play with some of the ideas, the conflicting, morality statements, the role of religion. I know what Rashmi's trying to say. I think the thing that the movie, despite the wonderful performances of the actresses, it lacked any real heat between them in the sense of, yes, it was very sexual, but you never felt their romantic longingness. And so I think it maybe missed the mark just on that. But nonetheless, I thought the movie was a fascinating look into a world we don't know about through this relationship.
So I thought the movie was flat out brilliant. I liked everything about it. So I think the subject matter is kind of maybe controversial, if you will, but it shouldn't be controversial. It's 2018, but I just like the confidence of the movie. No, there is not a single scene in this movie which is wasted.
Right.
This is a remarkable filmmaker. And I was just, even in the first 5 minutes, I was amazed at how much economy there is in building characters. There are certain scenes which kind of define the Rachel Weisz character early on. There are some scenes later on which define the Rachel McAdams' character. And the shots are beautifully composed. They are, they all kind of click into each other. And the movie kind of at critical points does not necessarily connect the dots for you. It kind of, makes you say, okay, now you got to put two and two together. So I just like the confidence with which the whole thing was constructed. I don't know about, Orthodox Jewish community in London, certainly, but I never once doubted the authenticity of it.
Right.
It was totally authentic.
From the peeled paints on the doors to the synagogue to the
design of the houses,
And everything. And I think, like you said, Joseph, it could be about anything. It essentially, even though it's set in about a very specific relationship in a very specific religious and spiritual setting, it could be about any individual, and in fact, most individuals are struggling with what you are expected to be by virtue of where you're born versus what you want to be,
or what you are,
of what you are in your heart. And I think, the same sex part kind of is an extension of that, but it could have been about anybody who is struggling with what your parents want you to be versus what you want to be. And kind of it presented the two characters, the two Rachels I saw, as the person who kind of, gives in to what their family expects from them versus the Rachel Weisz character being the person who has the courage to say, the hell with it, I'm not going to put up with it. And I liked, it's funny, there's been a lot of talk about the two Rachels, and I think both Rachels deserve an Oscar nomination. They're that good here. One of the comments on Letterboxd just said, how wonderful is inter-Rachel love?
That's a great line.
But I think, oddly, the movie reminded me of a third Rachel, which is the movie Rachel Getting Married, which also was about this very kind of untethered Bruce character who suddenly shows up in a very intimate, familial situation, and it's like a bomb. She, detonates a bomb. She shows up there, and she just... everything starts falling apart.
Yeah.
And it's the same situation. There's this very close-knit community which has a hierarchy, and the father of the rabbi dies, and this daughter comes back, and she's like this detonation, and she shows up there, and everything falls apart around her. And it kind of, maybe I was reading too much into the movie, but it's about the inevitable... the inevitable coming together of reality versus tradition. Eventually tradition is going to have to face with what's outside of it. And I liked how it kind of resolves it. I liked how the movie ends. It kind of avoids the usual, I don't want to give too much away, but it doesn't play by typical, movie conventions in terms of how things are resolved.
Yeah.
And I completely bought, just like in Blue is the Warmest Color, I bought the fact both of those actors are able to play somebody who is so consumed by passion that they cannot be rational anymore in the moment. And that's a very difficult thing to convey, I think. And both of these actors, I think they're able to convey that they have so much at stake, especially the Rachel McAdams character, but the passion just, she has no control over it.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a bonus Netflix pick. Yes. There is a great movie, it's a documentary, it's called One of Us, and I've mentioned it before. And basically, the tagline is, in the wake of trauma and abuse, three Hasidic Jews face ostracism, anxiety, and danger as they attempt to leave their ultra-Orthodox community. It's actually set in Brooklyn, and I've mentioned it on one of the podcasts before. That's one movie I want everyone to watch. And Menashe, which just came out at the end of last year. I think it was nominated. I can't remember. Anyway, it was brilliant. And that was about...
A father
who basically ends up losing his wife, and there's pressure on him from his community to remarry. That's not a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's what I think is missing from this movie, which is why I'm reacting the way I am versus the two of you. I think the issue I had is that in this community, the only bad people, the only people who had doubt about their religion were these two. And I think had this had some flaws in some of the other people that looked at religion and community in a more critical lens, then it would have been a more realistic movie. But as it stands, it sounded and it felt like these were the only two people impacted by this desire, and I don't believe that's the case. And so that's what made it unbelievable for me. And that's why I'm saying watch these other two movies that I've mentioned, because they managed to strike a better balance about the joys of being in a community and the benefits versus...
Rashmi, I don't think the movie was trying to undermine the religion.
Yeah. No, I don't think it was either. It was more about
the connection between the women.
Correct. But I think if you take... For me, that's why it felt a bit more... unbelievable, and I couldn't buy into that relationship as much because it was solely about these two being unable to reconcile what their community or their religion wants from them versus something that sits in a bit more reality. And that's just from my own perspective as I'm watching that movie.
The reason why... I think that's fair. It's based on a book of fiction, you know, on a fictional work. So I can't comment on how realistic it is. And again, I'm not familiar with the... But I agree with Joe is that to the movie's great credit, it never kind of looks to, you know, satanize that religion. I mean, it says this is how it is and this is the price you pay for being part of this community.
Sure.
But I actually think it affects everyone. I mean, she literally, Rachel Weisz's character, when she shows up, it is like a bomb because everything falls apart. It's not just her relationship. I think everybody goes through an arc, but I think the person whose arc was most touching for me is the arc of Esty's husband, Rachel McAdams' husband. David, who is heir apparent, like I said, to become the next rabbi. And he's unable to reconcile. He sees how tormented his wife is, and he's unable to reconcile this religion to which he's 100% committed with what his wife is going through. And he goes through a transformation, and I don't want to give anything away. So I think it's more than just those two characters, and it's people around him, around them as well. Aunt, when Rachel Weisz's character eventually does show up for her father's funeral, the other members of their family, they know know about the relationship between these two women, but they still, as disdainful as they're about it, they welcome her saying, "We know you're here to pay homage to your father." So I think it's a growing up exercise.
It's for the fact all that the relationship is treated kind of like a sickness from it which is. One can recover. And so they all kind of just dismiss it for what it is. It's not a religious thing. They just kind of think that they look
it's
down.
It's a perception,
Yeah. But, I mean, you mentioned the husband, David. if this was award season, he'd easily be up for a best supporting.
Yeah, I agree.
He had a very, very difficult role to play here. And I believed every single line of dialogue that he uttered. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, he doesn't say a lot at times to, you know, give away the internal turmoil that you described so well just there yesterday. I think this is an actor who really had to think deeply about how he was going to convey this, and he really nailed it for me.
Yeah, because he kind of goes through the motions where he initially is really angry because he can't understand why his wife, who according to him has everything, why she's behaving the way he is. And there's a great scene where he just completely loses it with her and he's screaming. And then you can almost see his evolution where he kind of tries to put himself, and it's all done wordlessly. There is not any dialogue said, and he kind of starts questioning his own faith, and he starts questioning his purpose in all of this, and ultimately he kind of, I don't want to give anything away, but
yeah,
he does an amazing thing, I think, you know, towards the end of it. So it's his journey as well, and I think, I don't know, I think it's all just, you know, you love what you love. It really worked for me. I mean, for me, like, this movie was 10 times better than Carol. I mean, I was so disconnected off of Carol. I was glaring wonderfully at the beauty of it all, but I couldn't feel a thing for those two characters. Here, I was aching for those two characters.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, let's sum up. Yes, Dee, that sounded like a bit of a summing up.
Yes, easily one of the best films of the year. I can't find a single thing that is wrong with it. And, you know, you just fall in love with some movies, you know, and you do without reason. I love the confidence of the movie, how it plays out. And it has an inevitability about it. I knew that it was headed to some really tragic place. Even though I didn't know where it was headed, I could see it head that way. So I just like the confidence with which it's been made. And, you know, I cannot overstate how brave both of the Rachels are in this movie. I mean, these are big name actors, like, just leaping into the unknown. Neither one of them needs to take this on and do it. And I think, especially Rachel McAdams, she could be the pretty face and coast on that for the rest of her career, but she chooses really interesting. And she has the more difficult role, I think, because she is very devoted, but absolutely, she's overcome by her desire. And that's very hard to do without being judgmental. So I'm rambling a lot. 8.5 out of 10. I want to give it a 9, but I'll give it a 9 because it's a movie which needs the recognition. It really does. It's quite something.
Yay! I made Yazdi give a 9. Yeah. Yay!
My second 9. This
Yay!
Year.
Yes. Joe.
You know, yeah. Everything you said there, I mean, I think I don't quite hold the movie in the same high esteem as you, simply because I feel like, you know, they're a little bit. To Rashmi's point, there's a couple of soap opera moments, you know, somebody just happens to walk by, at a certain point in time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the plot plods on to what is the obvious repercussion of that. So there's no tension in something that could have been played out for a little bit more suspense. But nonetheless, you know, that's my movie making critique, not my movie reviewing critique. I enjoyed the movie a lot. I mean, it sits somewhere between a 7 and an 8. I'm going to round down today. I think it's just a, you know, one or two little things that kind of prevent me holding it a higher esteem. So 7 out of 10. Rashmi.
Look, this is great actresses doing great work, but it's a little overcooked for me and a little bit implausible. So, and I wanted so much more. So again, I think this may just be an expectations thing. And again, I really recommend our listeners to go and watch Menashe and One of Us, which is currently on Netflix. One of Us, the documentary. 6 out of 10.
Okay. Moving on. Let's wrap up the podcast with a brief review of Incredibles 2. So I say brief review only because, Yazdi, you are the only one of us that has seen this so far. And that's...
And we can't banter with them.
Despite our very best efforts to try and get out there this weekend to
see it. Football.
Okay, football. So, Rashmi, I think you're going to tell us about Incredibles 2.
Yeah, so Brad Bird is back in... another version or a sequel to the original Incredibles, which was brilliant. It was incredible. And I believe this is a story about Mr. Incredible being left to babysit whilst Mrs. Incredible or Elastigirl takes a break. Yasti, was this as incredible as The Incredibles?
Was it Incredible 2?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Pixar has made their share of, you know, instant classics in the animation genre.
And not so many.
And not so many, but, you know, they're early
Cars 2.
Oh, gosh. Don't remind me. But they have made their share, and I've always held, you know, Incredibles at very high esteem. Because, again, mind you, The Incredibles original one came out before, you know, all this hoopla with Marvel and all this, you know, which has consumed, right, you know, Hollywood whole. So it was kind of relatively, you know, a new thing to watch, you know, superheroes kind of be human and have human frailties and kind of have a sagging tummy and so forth. So it was funny. And just the visuals of it was so amazing. You know, it has this...
And the story was cute.
And the story was cute as well. So this movie is directed by Brad Bird, you know, who's done, you know, masterpiece after masterpiece. He even did that incredible Mission Impossible movie.
That's right.
Very directed. Very good.
Ghost Protocol. Was that one his?
Or maybe yes, it was Ghost. No, it's Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol, yeah.
So everything about the original Incredibles is here. There is no slacking off in any of it. It's beautifully created. The movie opens with a wonderful little piece.
I feel a huge butt coming.
Yeah, there's a butt coming. I mean, the movie has visually, it has this mid-century modern look, you know. But I don't know, it felt like I was walking down a memory lane again. Like I have been to this place, and instead of kind of building on it, it just seemed another episode of that. So just a slight bit of a disappointment.
Okay.
I mean, it's not a knock it out of the park classic for me. It's more of the same. And maybe I need to see it again. But it didn't... It amused me, but it didn't thrill me.
It's running 94% on the Tomatometer. And the original Incredible sits at 97, which I find... pretty incredible,
yeah,
that it's maintained that over 90 score, you know, over the years.
There's also this piece where, because of the quandary that Elastigirl is in, Mr. Incredible, you know, these other superheroes, superheroes are illegal. So they gather up all these other superheroes who have all these other powers, and they kind of... are meant to kind of form a team, but it just seemed really reminiscent to me of like the Avengers, where all these different superheroes get together. So that kind of soured things a little bit for me. You know, the movie has enough going for it. It's been a while since I watched the original Incredibles, but baby Jack-Jack, you know. I think he was just cooing in the first one, but in this film... we find out that baby Jack-Jack also has superpowers. Mm-hmm. And
I think they showed themselves right at the end of...
the first one.
The ending scene, yeah.
But baby Jack-Jack just completely steals the movie. I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but there's... I think one of the reasons why Pixar is Pixar is because they don't play by the rules. You know, they don't think, you know, a movie should be... It should stray away from dark themes, or it should have a particular order. But there's this perfectly surreal, absurd piece where Jack-Jack interacts with this raccoon, you know, and it's just something else. I mean, it just leaps off the screen. And I wish the rest of the movie were like that as well.
So I'm keep trying to interrupt here because I'm going to read you a quote. And this quote is, "We don't want to make safe films. We want to keep breaking barriers in story and animation. We have incredible ideas for original stories. It's so rare to do original work. That's what we can do. It's what we have to do." That's a quote from John Lasseter, who is unfortunately recently disgraced, this executive from Pixar. But he was, for many years, the creative force behind the studio. And Pixar was very famous at one point for absolutely rejecting this concept of sequels. And I've been very disappointed with their sequel after sequel after sequel. Cars 2 and 3, we've had Incredibles 2. We had, there was another one,
Well, Toy Story 2 and 3, but Monsters University.
Monsters Universities, yeah.
That was good.
No, but my point is that, you know, what used to bring the magic with Pixar, and we saw it again, you know, to some extent with, you know, Inside Out, was these original stories that only they seem to be able to do. And so I feel like, you know, the Disney interference and the franchising and the, you know, has taken something away. And I feel like that's what you're saying here. This would have been a magical movie had we not already had a dose of this same flavor ice cream before. And as you know, it's never the same second time.
And, you know, make no mistake, it's still vastly superior to anything else I've seen by way of animation in 2018. It's just that I have incredibly high expectations for a sequel to this movie. And it just takes off and gets into giddy, absurd territory far too rarely, I would like for it. I mean, the action scenes in this movie, which is a weird thing to say about an animated movie, but the action scenes in this movie are just...
No, I don't think amazing. That's weird at all.
I mean, there's this whole... You know, I don't think Elastigirl was used to her full effect in terms of her elastic capabilities, but there's some incredible set pieces where she has to go through tunnels and she separates herself into two and she dodges, and it's just so much creativity there. But, and, you know, it has... at the end of the day, the villain in the movie wasn't as bad as I would have liked. You know, remember in the original Incredibles, it was this kid who was like kid gone crazy. So maybe not as memorable. So I think a 7 out of 10, and a generous 7 out of 10. Yeah.
Okay.
A 6.5, which I'm bumping up to 7 out of 10.
That's okay, because you gave something a 9.
I gave something a 9. Yeah.
So, okay. Well, Incredibles 2. So let's finish up the podcast. It's getting late, and it's still a school night here for us. Movie Rollers' dedication once again to the craft of podcasting. mail@movierollers.com. Let us know what you think of this podcast, of our podcast in general, of anything that you want to think about. Hey, spam us. We'd like to get some email at all. Facebook.com/movierollers, Twitter.com/movierollers. Instagram.com/movierollers, and of course our main website. If you like us, then do give us a good review on iTunes. If you don't, then just don't. I think that will help us get some profile in the iTunes store, so that would be much appreciated. Until our next podcast, too many movies, too little time, a goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.